The views and opinions of the host, guests, and callers of Radio Free ARFCOM do not necessarily reflect those of AR15.com, BBS Radio, or their advertisers. When any techniques, skills, or theories are presented, they reflect the practices and opinions of the individual presenting them, but not necessarily those of Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, or BBS Radio. In all circumstances, Radio Free ARFCOM, AR15.com, and BBS Radio expressly disclaim any liability that may result in the use or misuse of any information featured in this program.
Transmission begins.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go.
Let's go.
All this stuff you've heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love to stick in battle.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
Radio Free ARFCOM starts now.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, fellow ARFCOM members, it's now time for your Radio Free ARFCOM, the Internet's voice for AR15.com, broadcasting live from sunny South Florida. This is your show. My name is Benjamin, and I'm just the guy behind the mic hosting. So feel free to make it your show by calling us at 415-762-1161 or IMing me at FL_flyfishing_guide on AR15.com. Welcome back, and I'd love for you to share your thoughts and comments with us here at Radio Free ARFCOM. And also, please remember that Radio Free ARFCOM is always looking for sponsors. So if you or your company would like to advertise, please IM me on ARFCOM or send a message to the site staff. So let's get started. Like we did last week, I'd like to begin the show by addressing your comments and criticisms about me, the previous week's show, as well as any issues you, the ARFCOM listening audience, brings to my attention. Moving on to listener comments from last week. We had a couple of people saying that the show sounded good, and I certainly appreciate that. Everybody seems like they like the flow of the show a little bit better. The audio quality was a little bit better as well, and I really appreciate the positive remarks. Good job, great show, et cetera, et cetera. Thanks for keeping the background noise down, too. Yes, I am working on that as well, trying to make sure that you're eliminating any noise, and so you get a nice, clear signal from Radio Free ARFCOM. Again, thank you for all the positive comments, and thanks to Joe, Victor, and Jeff for appearing on last week's show. We are very pleased to have them as guests, as we are pleased to have all of our guests. I want to thank all the forum members who are helping generate topics and guest ideas. We really appreciate any help you can get. Just wanted to let you guys know a little bit about the show and how it's made so you guys can help to participate. Because, I'd like to have the most amount of listeners and audience participation that we can have. And basically what it is I have a producer that I work with, but as far as the show and guests, basically it's a lot of work for me. I basically have to email and IM everybody and put forth a lot of effort to try to get the show started for the next week as soon as the show basically is finished. Tomorrow morning when I'm at work, and basically the whole rest of the week I'll be working on trying to put together next week's show. And I am doing this for free for you guys, just so you know, any help would really be appreciated. If you guys do have some guests or some contacts that you might think would want to hook me up with, that'd be really great. It's difficult trying to generate the content that you guys can appreciate out there in ARFCOM land, and we're trying to keep it all relevant to you guys. And again, as I always say, any comments and feedback that you guys can provide me, I'd really appreciate to let me know where you guys want to see the show and how we can help out the ARFCOM members as well as our sponsor, AR15.com. And a little recap of last week's show, in case you missed it, in celebration of Independence Day, I did a few patriotic readings from the Declaration of Independence, as well as Thomas Paine's Common Sense. And I think that was a nice topic to go through, particularly on the Independence Day holiday. I hope everybody, if you didn't get to tune in because you're having friends and family for your holiday, we really hope you had a great Independence Day. And if you didn't catch the previous week's show, you can certainly go to the Radio Free ARFCOM forum in the AR15.com general section. Joe and I talked about Chicago pushing for new restrictions, and in light of the McDonald decision, we also discussed getting the message out and recruiting new members and making new gun owners through positive experiences and training. Again, we're really trying to reinforce that not only do we want to share our love of the sport and the hobby of the whole thing, but also get the message out about making sure we maintain a freedom of access to the things we all know and love. Victor from Tactical Night Vision Company was on. His website is tnvc.com. Really excellent website. If you guys didn't catch that, he had a really nice interview regarding the new applications for night vision as well as thermal imaging. One of the things that I found particularly interesting was that the more and more police departments and agencies are incorporating night vision throughout the country. Another interesting point that he made was that EMS, fire departments, and first responders were using thermal imaging in order to help them find accident victims or people that are in the burning buildings and whatnot. So he said they're pretty regular additions to many of the fire departments. So that's good to know that our first responders have the tools at their disposal in order to save lives. We also discussed with, again, Victor from Tactical Night Vision, civilian and potential uses for night vision and thermal imaging. Said that the prices will eventually come down once a new generation of night vision is produced. We should start seeing some of those prices come down. We're going to ask some of that about later on with one of our guests in the show. Following that, we had Jeff from OK Shooting. It's Okeechobee Shooting Sports. Again, okshooting.com. He operates a 85-acre gun range and what we consider more of a firearms park as opposed to just standard, what you would consider a regular quote-unquote gun range. He said that one of the things you needed was not only you needed a big pile of money, but there's a lot more to it installing a gun range than just a bulldozer and a couple of acres and one of your buddies. You need an architect and designers and all that. And some of the challenges and obstructions that he had mentioned were from the communities, from the neighbors, from potential non-sympathetic administrators at all levels of local government and so on and so forth. Indeed, he did discuss trying to create a very family-friendly atmosphere with all good NRA-certified instructors, range officers, and a good quality staff to make the OK Shooting a very quality destination, not just a one-shot deal, but an all-day family-friendly affair. So that was a pretty interesting segment. Again, if you guys want to take a look at that, or listen, I should say, you can go ahead and go to the Radio Free ARFCOM archives. Please feel free, guys, all the listeners out there, to submit any member news and events to me if you would like me to get that info on the air. Also, if you have any interesting and fun ideas for show segments, anytime you want to spice up the show and you got some either funny or creative or any other types of ideas, I'd be more than happy to have your submissions. Looking through ARFCOM GD, we know that there's always a lot of crazy stuff going on in there. And, you know, thinking about maybe doing a dinner pick of the week segment. So if you guys want me to compile it or you want to submit it to me, just let me know. And I was thinking maybe we could interview the submitters. That's just a thought. Excuse me. We had a submission by a member, Hawswood. I'll go ahead and read this to you. The Wisconsin Hometown Forum is having an ARFCOM gathering at the Chiafton Range on Saturday, July 24th. For more info, visit the planning thread in the Hometown Forum. An interesting story is that the 500-yard range is owned and maintained by the village, and the park is free. They do have suggested donation honor boxes for $3. The link is www.shioston.org. That's, I suppose, shioctin.org. And then follow the links there for the range pamphlet and document. This weekend, I had a fun, interesting weekend. We did a little kayaking and snorkeling over one of the local reefs here in town by me in Florida. And what I noticed was some tar balls floating emulsified and suspended in the oil. We all know that we're about beyond the 80-day mark on the BP oil spill, and obviously there's no way of knowing whether or not that was related, but seeing this sort of emulsified liquid oil floating over one of my favorite reefs was a bit disconcerting. One of the main things that Joe and I from the NRA talked about was the importance of writing and emailing all your newspapers, media outlets, congressmen, representatives, and all those guys. So me trying to do my best, I'm going to read you a little bit of this email that I sent to the letter to the editor of our local paper here to see if they would potentially publish it. Quote, this past weekend, a friend and I who frequently kayak and snorkel over the Tiger Shores beach noticed a half dozen or more tar balls suspended just below the surface of the water. We observed the tar ball Saturday, July 10th, 2010, about 3 p.m. I personally had tar balls float by me as I was underwater snorkeling. Our location was just over the reef. It was a low incoming tide with a visibility of about 15 to 20 feet. The tar balls appeared emulsified and were floating about a foot below the surface. We frequently snorkel and free dive this beach and have never seen tar of any kind in the water. 3 weeks ago, the water was crystal clear, like in the Bahamas, as clear as we had seen it in years. There was still an abundance of bait fish, as well as predators such as Spanish mackerel and tarpon, as well as sea turtles. The tar balls were sporadic, yet clearly apparent. I went on to tell them that we didn't try to collect any samples of the tar for fear of damaging our wetsuits, gloves, kayaks, and other gear, but that the tar balls were there. I concluded my letter to the editor by saying, obviously, there is no evidence that these tar balls are connected to the BP oil spill, but I feel it is my obligation to inform the local media of these observations, end quote. Again, one of the best ways I think that we can, as astute and observant citizens of our nation, and we can have to be on the front lines of writing letters to editors and to media and to our representatives to make sure that the voices of the citizens are heard. One of I'm sure those of you that are following the Tea Party movement are more than familiar with that rallying cry of local activity in trying to make positive changes for our country. Went shooting on Sunday, did a little bit of five stand and skeet, and noticed some of the differences and challenges of those sports and in related to not just those disciplines in particular, but any shooting discipline that I'm sure our listeners are interested in, whether it be tactical shooting or clay shooting or target shooting or pistol shooting or whatever the case may be. No matter what shooting discipline you like or aspire to get better, A good coach or a mentor is vital to help you improve and correct errors you might not notice. I had a gentleman that I met through my gun store that I run, and I also happened to take a couple of NRA certified instructor courses with him, and he's sort of taken me under his wing. He's used to be a very good competitive shooter in skeet. For him, you know, shooting 100 straight clays wasn't that big of a challenge. Again, it does pay to have a mentor or a friend or someone who can at least take a step back and observe what you're doing and point out your errors. So I would really recommend that for you and really enthusiastic shooters to get out there and do try to find a mentor or a coach. If you go to the NRA.org/programs online, and then you can go ahead and scroll down. It's the NRA's website, obviously. If you go down to the firearms training, again, that's NRA.org/programs, and then scroll down to firearms training and click on that, and it has their training department, hunter services, women's programs, youth programs, gunsmithing, all kinds. You can go on the left tab of the page. They have links for training, for instructors, for training counselors, who are the ones who would actually be training NRA certified instructors such as myself in the various disciplines. They also have links for coaches, youth programs, youth shooting, and shooting sports camps as well. So I really think it would pay the more serious shooters out there listening. You know, if you haven't ever had formal training or formal coaching for your particular discipline that you really enjoy, it does make a huge difference. No matter how good you think you are, everybody has, you know, flaws in their game, regardless of what they might be. So I would really recommend you guys check that out. A lot of it's through the NRA, so you know it's legit, good quality instruction and whatnot. And please try to support them and get out there and get some training if you haven't already. And it makes a big difference when you actually can see and feel the improvements in whatever discipline you're working on. Two other things you might be interested in. I just finished reading two new books. The first one that I read was a book called Obama Zombies by Jason Matera, How the Liberal Machine Brainwashed My Generation. And this is a book primarily targeted, it would seem to be, the 18 to 25 or 30-year-old audience. So it was a little bit just below my age bracket, but still very relatable to some of the things that I remember from going to college. I'll just read you a blurb out of the front cover. Quote, in 2008, Barack Obama lobotomized a generation. For an entire year, otherwise clear-thinking members of the most affluent, overeducated, information-drenched generation in American history fell prey to the most expensive, high-tech, laser-focused marketing assault in presidential history. And the book goes on to really describe in very good detail about how the lengths that Obama and his allies went to try to transform a generation into diehard Obama voters through a variety of very interesting and strategic means. So if that's something that might be interesting to you, again, that's Obama Zombies by Jason Matera, How the Liberal Machine Brainwashed My Generation, particularly if you have friends or relatives or family that are in, you know, that age group or maybe you know an Obama zombie that's been sort of tricked into this and sort of brainwashed by all the media campaigns and these supposedly nonpartisan organizations that are really just shills for the liberal machine. You might want to check that out or have them read it. It's certainly easy to relate to, particularly given the massive amount of media and particularly the bias. I also read Glenn Beck's new book, The Overton Window, a thriller, and this is a fictional book centered around a PR relations executive, and it's really about how perspective can fuel the way people think and the way people feel. And the Overton window is basically the way that the messages through the media and through things like public relations and government, it's all about how the messages are framed and how it gives you a chance to really think about how deep some of these things can be when you really think about who the producers are and where we're hearing it and really framing the discussions of the issues that we have in today's America and world. So again, the Overton Window by Glenn Beck. It's pretty good read, went real easy, and pretty thrilling conspiracy sort of story if you like that. In the news at the NRAILA.org, the NRA appeals the Pittsburgh lost and stolen gun statute. The National Rifle Association fired off another attempt Friday to strike down Pittsburgh lost or stolen gun ordinance. The NRA is appealing a June ruling from the state Commonwealth Court that upheld a city ordinance requiring gun owners to report lost or stolen guns to police within 24 hours of discovering they are missing. Also, Massachusetts, showdown expected on gun rationing legislation. Gun control advocates and critics are gearing up for a showdown on Governor Deval Patrick's crime bill in the waning days of this year's legislative session. Saying the matter could come to a vote as early as next week, the NRA this week asked supporters to call members of the House Ways and Means Committee to urge them to oppose Patrick's proposal. So again, make sure that you people up there and up in the Northeast go ahead and email and call and beat down the doors of your legislators to make sure that you guys are protecting your freedoms. Iowa, local gun bans violate state law. Proposed or enacted gun bans on public property in two Iowa communities likely violate state law, as well as a person's constitutional right to bear arms, gun rights activists told local officials last week. Last week, the NRA sent West Burlington city leaders a letter that said the group will oppose the city's ban on carrying weapons in municipal buildings, quote, with every means at our disposal. Going on, lot. Chicago's Mayor Richard Daley wants to ban guns, all guns. As always, gun control proponents say they merely want, quote, reasonable gun control laws. Yet, when listing the actual laws they favor, they go well beyond what most people would possibly consider reasonable. Just look at the gun bans in Chicago and D.C. and the local anti-gun organizations. Moving on from there, the Fox News had an interesting article, Chicago trying to enforce gun restrictions after high court ruling. Going on Fox News again, the Chicago government is taking another shot at enforcing sweeping handgun restrictions, bringing a new law into effect Monday meant to comply with the Supreme Court's landmark ruling that while still regulating firearm purchases. The new ordinance was drafted in response to the Supreme Court. Under the policy, it would limit each person in each home to own, quote, one assembled and operable firearm. Restrict residents from having firearms outside their home, even on their porch or backyard. Mandate training program attendance. Prohibit the sale of firearms inside city limits. Mayor Richard Daley called the measure a, quote, reasonable and responsible ordinance in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling. He goes on to say, when the wrong people have access to guns, whoever they are, whether they're gangbangers and drug dealers or abusive parents or sons or daughters, needless violence is more likely to happen whether it's in our streets or on our homes, unquote, he said in a written statement. So he says, whoever they are, and then he goes on to stereotype all gun owners, in my opinion, as gangbangers, drug dealers, abusive parents, and sons or daughters. So there he is, demonizing all of us responsible gun owners and looping us all into a group. No surprise there coming from him. The NRA response to that is coming from, again, the NRAILA.org. They say, the quote, the Supreme Court told Mayor Daley in the city of Chicago that it has to respect the Second Amendment. By enacting this ordinance, their response is make us, unquote, said director of the NRA ILA, Chris Cox. The NRA will not rest until Chicago's law-abiding residents can exercise the same freedoms that our founding fathers intended all Americans to have. Recent statements by Chicago officials reflect their contempt for the Supreme Court decision. Alderman Daniel Solis stated, quote, the decision made by the Supreme Court is not really in the best interest of our citizens, unquote. He also goes on to call the another city council member went on to call the Supreme Court poor judgment. So I'm sure she's a constitutional scholar in order to make that statement, but apparently we will find out. Going on to the armed citizen. A member of the military, just back from a tour of duty overseas, was traveling in a car with a companion around 11 p.m. in Cincinnati, Ohio, when an armed criminal attempted to rob the men. The veteran, a right-to-carry permit holder, retrieved a gun and shot the criminal, ending the attempted robbery. One of the men traveling in the car suffered a non-threatening gunshot wound to the arm. While the criminal was struck in the abdomen, both were taken to a local hospital. That's out of WKRC, Cincinnati, Ohio. Moving on, we have a special guest on the line. That would be one of our own ARFCOM members, Matt Hoffman. Matt, are you there?
Yes, Ben, I am.
Hi, Matt. How you doing? This is Benjamin, and on the line again we have Matt Hoffman, a relatively prolific poster on ARFCOM, and he's got an interesting project going on. And if you guys are online now, I'd really encourage you to go to www.54summits.com. That's 54summits.com. And I'll give you a little bit of background of the project that Matt's undertaken. I'd really like you guys to go there and visit and watch it. The teaser that he has is really good. There's a nice blog on there and some progress. And I'm going to go ahead and let Matt give you guys a little bit of information, and we'll talk about what he's trying to do. Go ahead, Matt. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. It's interesting being back on Radio Free ARFCOM as a guest as opposed to one of the hosts. Do want to apologize to everyone out there who was enjoying the Going Galt segment. Unfortunately, after we had done that interview with Jeffers, who has basically lived Going Galt for several decades, actually, it became all too evident that as far as the broad scheme of things go for that topic, we've covered everything we could. Going Galt is something that's very personal. It's going to vary widely on the very specific. So I did not think that I had anything else to add to it. So that was kind of the lead up to the end of that program. But this effort that we're talking about now, the 54 Summits effort, was effectively the last nail in the coffin, as my time just became way too consumed with it. The whole idea of this is that there are obviously a whole lot of mountains out here in Colorado, and as a new resident to this great state, I wanted to get out there and check them out. Spent my whole life growing up in the Northern Virginia area, and there's nothing remotely near what would be considered a mountain out in that area. So this was something that was relatively new to me. I wanted to get out there, take a look at it, and I was just at a loss of words and even sometimes breath getting up on top of some of these things and just taking in the view. So looking around at what the opportunities were, I discovered that Colorado is well known for something called 14ers. These are mountains that have a summit at elevation above 14,000 feet above sea level. And there's about, there's officially 54 of them. There's different criteria that's used to decide on the number, but the commonly accepted figure is that there's 54 of these things. I decided that it would be a really great opportunity for me to get out there and start climbing these things. Now, what I noticed in doing my research is that a lot of people have done this. A lot of people are doing it. But one of the things that they like to do is when they reach the summit, they take a picture and about a single picture, maybe two or three, and that's it. That's all they have to bring back to show all the hard work that they put into that ascent. And I wanted a little bit more than that. I wanted something that, actually something that I could show to my daughter in the future to inspire her, to encourage her that, you know, there's more to life than sitting behind a desk or just working a 9-to-5 job and waiting to get home to sleep and then wake up the next day to repeat it. There's more to life outside of keeping up with the Joneses. And I thought that this might actually open a unique opportunity. We're at a point where the technology for capturing video, and not just common video, high-definition video, is at a point that it is so compact and so light. There's no reason that I couldn't take one of these things up the mountain with me. And that eventually evolved into this idea that I would document my ascent of every single one of these mountains to provide not only something for myself to reflect back on, and not only something for my daughter and her future and even maybe her children in the future to inspire them, but something to maybe beyond that encourage other people to get out there and do it. Or beyond that, even for people who are actively undertaking this effort, to watch the video and kind of get an idea of what trail conditions will be like, what to expect, just to get some more information beyond some of the already fantastic websites that are out there with tons of trail descriptions and photos. Not too much video I've seen on it, so I thought this would be an opportunity to contribute.
That sounds great. Then you said you recently got into Colorado, and how long have you been there? And since you've been there, How long did it take you to come up with this idea and then get through the, you know, sort of the incremental stuff where you're now obviously you have the website and the blog, but sort of what's your timeline as far as where did this start and then where in the whole sequence of events are you?
Well, I moved out to Colorado at the beginning of November. Wasn't long after that actually moving to the Colorado Springs area, we have Pikes Peak right behind us, and it gives a beautiful backdrop to the west. So it's naturally enticing you to come and take a look at it. I started doing that, unfortunately starting to get into the winter season, but that only meant, you know, bundle up a little. There's another thing here called the Manitou Incline. It's a trail that is 1 mile long, goes up 2,000 feet, basically straight up a mountain. At its steepest, it's like 69% grade, and at an average of about 48% grade. So in doing this, I really found that I was really enjoying these difficult but memorable hikes, and I wanted to get more into it. I wanted to reach the summit of Pikes Peak by trail because I had already done it by the train, the Cobb Railway that will take you up there. And in November, on Veterans Day holiday, actually, the wife and I drove the whole family up the highway to the summit. So I set a little goal for myself. I want to reach the summit by all the methods possible within 1 year. And I started working on that. And in the process, I realized, hey, I'm actually getting into great shape doing this. And since I've started this, I've actually lost 30 pounds, and it's still coming off. And after reaching one of these, I decided, this is amazing. There's 53 more of these. I got to get into this. So I started planning into it. I started figuring out how I was going to film these things. And it's, I'll tell you, it's excruciating. It's painful. It's really trying going up them. But the sight and the feeling of accomplishment once you reach the top is amazing.
And what are some of those difficulties and challenges you were speaking of in terms of not just the physical, but also, you know, I guess logistical requirements as well?
By and far, the heaviest thing that I carry up the mountain is my camera gear. Even though it's a very small, very light, high-definition camcorder, that, with extra batteries, takes weight. I had to purchase a flash card only. Camcorder, not one with an internal hard drive, because hard drives actually have trouble operating above 10,000 feet. Add into that a Nikon camera with another lens and some other equipment, and sooner or later I have a pack that's 10, 15 pounds, and I don't even have water or any other gear in there. So logistically, I get slowed down, and I carry a whole lot more weight on my back than your average hiker, specifically because I'm recording this information. But I'm easing into it, and I think this is a good point to get into this. There, the Yosemite Decimal System is something that's used to rank the difficulty of trails to get places, class 1 through class 5. Class 5 is essentially technical climbing. That's where you're going almost vertically straight up. You're using rope, pitons, carabiners, harnesses, things like that. Class 1 is pretty much just put one foot in front of the other and get up the mountain. Class 2, a little bit more difficult. Class 3 is where you start getting into something called scrambling, which is essentially you're starting to move some points on the trail and across the rock on your hands and feet just to be able to get up it. And class 4 is borderline technical climbing. And I'm working my way up it because you can get to, for example, the tallest mountain in Colorado, the second tallest in the lower 48 states is Mount Elbert. And that's a class 1 trail. You really don't need much experience to, if you're doing it in the summer, just walk up the trail and make it to the summit. However, there's another one out here, and this one's going to take a while before I go for it, but there's one out here called Capitol Peak. And that one actually kind of spooks me a little because there's something you have to cross called the knife edge. It's not too far underneath the summit, but it's about, I'm recalling correctly, 300 feet or 300 yards or so of just very pointy, very jagged, like a knife edge with a 1,000 or 2,000 foot sheer drop on either side. Obviously, this is a class 4. So if you want to get out there, if you want to get into doing this, definitely take a look at some of these less difficult ones. Pikes Peak, Elbert, Quandary, Grays, Torreys. These are great peaks to start on. Some of the more notable ones, like Long's Peak, which is actually featured on the Colorado Quarter, I think the easiest trail to reach that one is a class 3. So if you haven't done any real difficult hiking before, I wouldn't recommend it. But whatever your skill level, it's amazing the number of mountains out here. And these are just 14ers that I'm talking about. It's amazing the number of mountains out here that will provide you an opportunity to get out there, try these things out, and just take in the amazing view from the top of one of these things.
And when you describe the filming, are you actually filming this yourself, or do you have an additional cameraman with you?
One should never do one of these things alone. And sometimes I have been forced to go alone, but the nice thing about it is the ones that I'm doing right now to start are so popular, and it's done on weekends because I have a job, that even though I'm by myself, I'm never alone on the trail. There's always someone else there with me. These are very popular routes for locals. So when I can't find someone to come with me, I am by myself. And it's a little tricky managing the camera at that point and setting up shots, deciding how I'm going to film things. This definitely adds time to the ascent. However, when I am fortunate to get someone to come with me, it really does cut down on the time. And so far, what few people I have had join me on a couple of these hikes have been local Colorado ARFCOMers. The two that come to mind immediately are AZ-AR-15, accompanied me on an attempt on Pikes Peak, and Bruce Leroy, who is actually, if I recall correctly, very soon going to be deployed with the Army out into the sandbox. He accompanied me on Elbert, and frankly, we had a blast. Didn't matter who I was with. If you're with someone else, just having that company with you, someone to talk to, it really helps move faster. So it's unfortunate that I have to go alone sometimes, though for safety reasons I'm never on a very remote route. But whenever I can get someone to come with me, it's just incredibly enjoyable. So I'm constantly looking for people who are in the Colorado area who want to do something like this, who would want to come along with me.
You were speaking about how you are getting in real good shape. I mean, did you train physically for this, or is it sort of a work in progress as you go along with more and more hikes? You're getting in better shape and coming along. And on the second part to that is are you going to be doing training for some of these technical climbs where you actually have to use, you know, the rope and you're actually, you know, scaling rock? Or is it mostly going to, I mean, or do they have the availability of trails going up all these 54 summits?
Okay, that's actually a philosophy that's evolved over time. The original mindset that I had was, this is great. I'm going to get in shape by climbing these things. And after a couple of failed attempts, I quickly realized that it's not like that at all. I need to get in shape to do this. And the best way to do that is, at least for climbing mountains, well, climb mountains. Like I said, one of my favorite things to do is the Manitou Incline out here. It will take me about an hour to get up that thing. I will feel completely beat up once I reach the top, but I got a great view the whole way, and it really helps me build endurance, burn off excess fat, and build leg muscles that I've certainly noticed helping out in future hikes. As far as the continuation of education on how to climb these things, like when we get into the more difficult ones like Capitol Peak, it's my intention to keep this as non-technical as I can, meaning in the case of Capitol Peak, there is only one way to reach that summit that does not involve technical climbing, and that's crossing that knife edge. However, for safety reasons, I obviously didn't want to jump into that and make that my first one. That may actually be my last one. But right now, there's plenty of Class 1 and Class 2 trails that are pretty easy, just put one foot in front of the other approaches to get me sort of built up more endurance-wise into this. But in the off-season, when it starts to get to a point that I need to be concerned with some of these Class 3 and even Class 4 trails, that's where I need to start getting an education and attend classes at local sporting stores like REI and get an education on something like climbing or, at the very least, rope work. So if I am going to be crossing a dangerous segment like that knife ledge on Capitol Peak, I know how to anchor myself. I know how to take care of that.
Yeah, I would imagine that that's probably, you know, like you say, you got a wife and daughter to worry about. You don't want to be going out on the most dangerous thing with no training or no, you know, without the proper safety equipment. But I'm also going to take a stab here and guess that Colorado's got a pretty significant, you know, amount of training available out there just because it's such a popular activity. But along those lines, you know, what gear do you take along with you? And how do you know what to take? And are you taking, you know, is it climbing gear? Is it survival gear? Is it a little bit of this, a little bit of that?
It depends on the hike, but more importantly, it depends on the weather. And no matter how much you can prepare for something, especially when you're getting to these mountain climbs, the weather is by far the most demanding factor that's going to decide what happens. Just this past weekend, I actually had to change plans from, instead of doing one mountain, to another, just because the forecast looked a little bit better for the second one. Actually, that's a whole other story there, but I'll digress from that one. The gear is largely weather-dependent, more in the sense of what season are we in. Obviously, if it's winter, I'm going to be taking a completely different set of gear than I would be right now in the summer, but right now, what I tend to do is I wear, there's a layering system when it comes to clothing. Layer 1, 2, and 3, and this is as you go away from the skin. The layer 1 will be right on the skin. And what I tend to wear is a merino wool base layer. And the nice thing about that is it wicks away sweat, but when wool is wet, it's still insulated. Unlike cotton. Cotton can be a dangerous thing to wear on the trail. If you get wet and it gets cold and you're wearing wet cotton, it can kill you if you have prolonged exposure. So a merino wool base layer is nice. But in the summer, there's no real need for layer 2, which is the insulating factor. But remember, it might be, say, 70 degrees down here in Colorado Springs, but you're going to drop about 4 degrees Fahrenheit for every 1,000 feet you go up. So if we're 70 degrees here in Colorado Springs, it's a safe bet that it's about 40, maybe less, on the summit of Pikes Peak. So if you need insulation, that's layer 2. But what I tend to go with is just the layer 1 and layer 3, which is the shell layer. You want a windproof, waterproof outfit. And what I wear, I actually have a gear review for this on the website. It's somewhere on the blog. Or you can go to my YouTube channel and find it there. It's a fabric called Event, and it's essentially Gore-Tex, but much more breathable. In fact, sometimes when I have to trudge through snow, I wear gaiters, which help prevent snow from getting into your boots. And I'm wearing them. Those are Gore-Tex, and they go over my Event pants. And I noticed that it's around that area, the lower part of my leg, where the gaiter is covering it, that's where I start to feel warm. That's where I start to feel some moisture buildup, because Gore-Tex does a great job breathing, but this other stuff, this Event, is amazing. I could easily wear it in 80-degree weather and out in the open sun and not feel hot in it at all. It breathes that well. So as far as clothing, that's great. I also wear wool socks for the very reason I wear a wool base layer, because I want to stay warm if I get wet. And obviously, a good pair of hiking boots with ankle support. I can't count the number of times that I have rolled my ankle going down these trails, but because I had a very, you know, nicely firm, tight boot strapped around my ankle there, it was no problem. I was just fine. As far as gear goes, the average person going, aside from your clothing, all you really need is first and foremost, a pair of sunglasses. I definitely want those. Second is sunscreen. I got a very nasty second-degree burn all over my face from not putting on sunscreen, so definitely bring that. Third, obviously, water and some food, whether it's snacks or lunch to bring with you. And I guess a camera if you'd like to take some pictures. But the only thing I can really think of beyond that I would absolutely say to bring, just because you never know what's going to happen, is a first aid kit. You may plan to pack light because, hey, I'm just going to go up there and come back down. It'll be fine. And what happens if you roll that leg and you actually do sprain your ankle? What then? You have to plan for these things in advance. And a lot of it has to do with, as I said, not just the weather, but how difficult the trail is. And more importantly, how many people are there? There's a kind of code of ethics that's shared amongst people who hike these things. And it's basically that you take care of each other. If you come across someone on a trail and they're injured, you render aid if you can. If aid has already been rendered, you see if someone needs to go and find a search and rescue to help them down the mountain if they need it. If that's already been taken care of, if there's absolutely positively nothing more you can do for that person, and they already have someone staying with them or they don't want you to stay with them, that's about the point where you make the decision, do I continue on? But you never just see someone get injured and say, oh, well, too bad for them, and press on. It's a very dangerous environment. It can turn very lethal out there with just a quick change of the weather. So obviously pack what you can to take care of yourself. But remember, there will be people there to help you if there's people there, but they're counting on you too if they get injured.
Again, for the ARFCOM audience listening, this is 54summits.com. And if you want to look at Matt Hoffman's video entry here, if you go to 54summits.com/blog and scroll down to, it looks like it's titled Video Blog Entry 001 Gear Review Event Fabric. That's the video that he was just describing, again, on 54summits.com. Again, we have Matt Hoffman here on the line. And continuing along, how far along on this journey are you as far as, you know, your completion? And do you have a timeline? And when do you expect to finish this journey up and down these mountains?
I don't really have a timeline for completion. I didn't want to set a deadline in the manner to make this like a chore or a task. I wanted to enjoy this. So if it takes me 2 or 3 years to do it, great. If it takes me 5 or 10, so be it. There are 54 of these things out there, and it takes time between having a job and managing logistics to take care of it. Another thing to keep in mind is what's called the climbing season, and that essentially rotates around summer out here, which I'm trying to pack as many peaks as I can into the weekends between June and late August. But once you start getting into mid, late September, that's when the snow starts to come in. So as far as shooting for season one goes, the mountain climbing is going to end around late August, early September. But I am currently mulling with the logistics about doing a winter season for season two. That is, climbing these things during the winter and having that available for broadcast come next spring. But I'm undecided on that right now.
Now, when and how do you plan on broadcasting this when you're finished? Obviously, you said you're doing a video blog, basically, but how do you plan on actually presenting this information and gathering viewers and all that?
They're going to be presented as webisodes. These are basically episodes like a TV show, only they're available only on the website. There's going to be two places you can find it. The videos are obviously going to be hosted on YouTube, like the current ones now. So they'll be available there on my YouTube channel, or they will be available for viewing on the website itself. If you go there, you'll notice on the left-hand side there's some sections in there, but what you don't see, and that I am going to be putting in there soon, will be a separate section for videos. And this is where you can go and you can watch sequentially each episode. Now, if you don't want to do that, there's already a section up there you can go to called Progress. You go there and it'll bring up a list of all the peaks that are targeted, along with an interactive Google map with each one highlighted and pinpointed. You can go and take a look at each one of those. And each one will have its own specific page that you can go to. And when you go to that page, when I have made a trip on the mountain, whether I have succeeded at it or not, there will be an entry. That entry, when you take a look at it, will show you on the map below, one, the GPS track path that I have taken. The other thing it will show you will be videos associated with that trip. So obviously if I had to take multiple attempts at the mountain, there will be multiple videos there. And I am also going to have photos from the camera available for people to look at that way. So whether you're going to watch it through the YouTube channel as if it was something on TV like a television show, or if you were going to follow it as more of a informative, wow, let's see how he's doing, whichever way you want to approach it, there will be a way available on the 54summits.com website for them to do that.
And for those of you following along on the internet, it's 54summits.com/progress. And if you look on the map here, he does have a little legend here with all the different names and the elevations of all the different peaks, as well as on the map there's all these little bubbles that show exactly where all these little peaks and dots are. And then he does have them color-coded from green to yellow to orange to red to dark red. I would guess indicating the perceived difficulty rating of the mountain.
The colors are tied to the class of difficulty. And one thing I'll point out right now that isn't immediately clear on there, but I may have to clear up in the near future, is that these classes pertain to the trails, not to the mountains themselves. Using one of my backyard, for example, Pikes Peak. On the website, it's coded as green, meaning class 1. Well, there's also a trail up there that's class 2. So if I climb Pikes Peak and I put the information on there, if it was the class 2 trail that I climbed instead of the class 1, you'll see it actually change. So remember that if you see a mountain with a certain color code, like, again, we'll use Pikes Peak as an example, and you see that it's green and you think, okay, this is pretty easy. Well, remember, it means that there is an option for the easy route. It does not mean that there won't be more difficult ones. So if you're looking for something a little more challenging, you can do it that way. But the one thing that I am pretty certain of is that whatever the color code is on these, and I will need to double check it, it's been a while since I built it, whatever the color code is on this, it represents the easiest path to the summit. So in a case like Long's Peak, where it's orange, meaning class 3, expect the class 3 would be the easiest trail available to the summit. So that would be a pretty difficult peak.
Right, so there's multiple options of getting up and down these mountains. And 14,000 feet of elevation seems like a pretty big number. What's your anticipated time that it takes you to get up and down one of these mountains, or is that more based on the difficulty of each trail?
Well, the time it's going to take you to get up to the mountain is going to depend on a lot of factors. Number one, first and foremost, is going to be you. What kind of physical shape are you in? Obviously, the better shape you're in, the faster you can move. Another thing to consider, and it doesn't apply as much to people who live out here in Colorado as it does to people who come in from out of state, is acclimating. You would not want to fly in from sea level and attempt to pull TINA the very next day. Your body just will not be used to it. The air will be too thin for you to handle. Your body hasn't had that time to produce the extra red blood cells that it needs to handle the extra oxygen frankly, you didn't need that many red blood cells for at sea level, but you would higher up. Third, of course, is the trail. How difficult is it? Is it a class 1? Well, that's pretty easy. Is it a class 3? Not so much. Four, the weather. it's one thing to do even a class one trail in the middle of summer and to do it again in the middle of winter. The only other thing that I could think would be a contributing factor would be, what are you carrying? Again, if you're just going to go out there and do this for yourself, you could probably manage to pull it off with a 10-pound pack or less, and that includes water. But if you're like me and you're carrying a lot of camera gear up there to document this stuff, it is not unusual to find yourself going up this mountain with a 20 or a 30-pound pack. And I'll go ahead and admit right now, that's after doing a significant amount of trimming, because on the very first attempt I ever made on one of these, I was carrying a 70-pound pack. I had all kinds of gear for winter, camping out, and frankly, I just didn't need it. I had this perception in my mind that I did, but I was wrong. And that extra gear slowed me down to a point where I was doing about a half mile an hour. So 6 miles down the trail was 12 hours later. But when you get some experience, you get a little bit more athletic, if you get a lighter pack and you're acclimated, it would not be uncommon at all to manage to sustain a 1 to 2 mile an hour pace going up these things. And you'll find that many of the trails, actually the longest trail to a summit of a 14er is Pikes Peak here. Bar Trail is 13.1 miles one direction, so 26.2 round trip. They actually run a marathon on it every year in the summer for that reason. So most often these trails are less than 10, even less than 8 miles one way. So if you figure that you keep that pace, you can figure out what time you need to start, because another rule you want to follow is to be off the summit by noon. I'll go ahead and share a little information on one that I did recently. I did not reach the summit until noon because I had misestimated how fast I would go. And with all the filming, I did not get off the summit until after 2 o'clock. Well, 2 o'clock, somewhere between the 1 to 3 p.m. window in the summer, that's when the thunderstorms start. I had to dodge 2 thunderstorms with active lightning strikes on the mountain above tree line. And I honest to God, believe it's nothing short of possibly a miracle that I am still alive after that. I would love to have had video of that, but one of the tactics you do if you're in a situation like that is take everything metal, take everything water that you have, and get as far away from it on the mountain as you can, because obviously those are conductors. So in the case of, say, a collapsible trekking pole that's made out of aluminum or some other metal, if you're in the middle of a thunderstorm on top of a mountain, that's not a trekking pole anymore. That's a lightning rod. Get that away from you. And the same would be the case with the tripod and the camera. So unfortunately, I don't have video of it, but again, be off summit by noon, and if you're in pretty good physical condition and you can, you're acclimated and you have a pretty light pack, it's not unreasonable at all to maintain 1 to 2 mile an hour pace doing these things. So it's entirely doable.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. Here on Matt's website, 54summits.com, excuse me, if you scroll down, he says specifically right on here, these storms usually appear 1 to 2, and the wisdom of the rule, be off the summit by noon. And you go on to say here, sometimes this happens when the tallest object on the mountain is you, in emphasis.
Especially what makes being on a mountain during a thunderstorm so dangerous, is if you're above tree line, lightning wants to strike the tallest object around. And that can be you from time to time. So there are certain things you have to do to take care of to address that. I found myself scrambling at a few points to manage that. But it's very frightening. And the best way to cope with it is to avoid it altogether. Make sure you're off that summit by noon, because that usually means that you'll be down below tree line by 1 to 2. Where even if storms come in, there's still danger, but you are not the tallest thing on the mountain where you are at that point anymore.
And when you're doing this, are you doing all the producing and editing of the show yourself, of the video and all that?
I am. I'm doing, this is basically a one-man band the way it is right now, with the exception of any company that comes along with me on these hikes.
Yeah, I do a similar thing. I run a shooting video website that, you know, we make and we film and we edit, and, you know, it takes an awful lot of time to produce this stuff, and then giving the content away basically free. Are you doing the same thing? Is this going to be a free thing? Are you looking for sponsors, or how is that working?
this will be free to the viewers. I am looking at ways to monetize it, maybe tie in some advertisements with it. Sponsorship would be nice in the future. But right now, there are absolutely no plans whatsoever to make this a membership-based thing. All the information that I am taking to reach these summits, the reports from other people, photos, trail descriptions, even some people have furnished GPS files to help get up the mountain. All these things are available free. And as I'm using them to help myself, it's just not right in my mind for me to take what I have produced from these resources that were provided to me at no charge and to turn around and charge for mine. There's a very active community out there that provides a lot of great information for climbing these things, and I would just feel like I was being more of a detriment to the community than a contributor if I was to say, hey, here's a video of me going up the mountain. You can rent it on YouTube for $2 for 5 days. So I want to make the content available to the end user, the consumer, at no charge.
We were speaking when we were IMing each other before the program about you have a very specific ARFCOM tie-in. Do you mind describing some of that and what your idea was for that and sort of elaborate on that plan of your little ARFCOM tie-in for these videos?
Right. Speaking of contributing to communities that have helped me, I know for a fact that the ARFCOM community has had a major impact on me, my life, been very helpful. A lot of great information on here that when you're looking at maybe purchasing a firearm or things like that, you know, there's a lot of lessons that you learn from people as to what to avoid so you don't make those common $100, $200 mistakes that you learn from. You listen to what people have to say on this website, you learn from it, you wind up saving money, and in the process, you meet some really great people. So even though I wanted to keep this separate from ARFCOM, I wanted to pay homage to ARFCOM while doing it. So it isn't going to be in the final videos. It's not going to be in the webisodes that will broadcast starting September 20th. But I am making available to team members in the team forum as I do them. I am providing video of me at the summit of the peaks I reach flying the ARFCOM full face logo flag.
That's excellent. I'm sure you'll get quite a number of hits on that. One of the things that when you were talking a little bit earlier about the trails, you said this is all, you know, basically public land. Are these trails, what should we consider, are they more natural, or do they have guides, or, you know, how do you navigate these trails and know where you're going and not, you know, make a wrong turn off the edge of the mountain or whatever? I mean, are they pretty well marked, or how does that whole, you know, concept work of what they have and how do you actually go about navigating?
Let me actually approach this as a two-part question. First and foremost, every 14er in Colorado is not on public land. The majority of them are, but there are two that are not. One is Mount Bross. It's located just outside of the town of Alma. And the other is Culebra Peak. And that is the southernmost 14er, only several miles north of the New Mexico border, actually. In the case of Culebra, it's owned by a ranch. They know they have a 14er that people are interested in climbing. And so you can make reservations with them in advance, sign a waiver, pay them a fee, and they will give you permission to go and climb the mountain. In the case of Bross, this is a situation where when you start getting into some of these mountains, you start getting into areas that 100 years ago, maybe a little more, were active mining areas. And I mentioned the town of Alma earlier. Alma was actually established as a mining town. It sits right at the foot of Mount Bross, which is heavily mined. And the problem there is that as the entire mountain is essentially private property between various mining companies, who even knows where some of them went anymore, you have a situation where you don't really have legal permission to reach the summit on that mountain. But fortunately, they did open a trail that goes underneath the summit on that mountain, but the summit itself is still not open. So there are some cases where you will pass through private property on some of these mountains, but an EV easements or a concession has been made by the landowner to allow people to pass through the property so long as they stay on this trail. Now, the second part of your question was, finding the trail. This depends on, again, what the class is. A class one trail is very easily identifiable. You can't lose it. You start getting up into the harder one, sometimes it can be tricky to find the trail. There are a few things you can do to help out with this. Number one is, I'll go ahead and plug the website right now because it's been such a huge help to me. 14ers.com, 14ers.com has just an absolute plethora of information. And one of the things that I frequently use on there is a GPX file from someone else who has climbed the route. I can load that into my GPS and know following that if I'm on trail or if I'm off, if there's any question. And it has from time to time been very helpful in trying to, like, coming to a fork or what appears to be a fork in a trail, and okay, do I go right here or do I go left? However, you do occasionally come across situations where portions of the trail are shut down for reclamation. And the whole meaning behind this is to help control the erosion of the land. And it's important that we abide by these restrictions and follow the trail as opposed to just running roughshod up the mountain. Because when you see these trails going through the alpine it's very clearly identifiable where the trail is. And if you think about everyone who's gone up this mountain, if they just went up however they wanted, the entire side of the mountain would look like that. And that's a horrible thing because a lot of the plant life in the alpine area, great example, there's a natural alpine grass that grows up there about 12,000 feet. That grass grows, if I remember correctly, about a quarter inch every century. That's how long it takes it to grow, just that little amount. So obviously if all that gets trampled down, it's going to be forever before it gets back up, certainly not in my lifetime. And we want to preserve, and that's what being a conservationist is all about. We want to preserve the beauty of the land, use it wisely, but the bottom line is we want to hand it off to our children and their children in just as good, if not better, condition than we received it in. So it does help to know where the trails are and use whatever tools, like these GPS files that I find on that website, 14ers.com, use them to your advantage, because I'm out here filming this for my child and her children and other people to enjoy. I don't want to contribute to the further decay of something and make it less beautiful for them should they ever come out.
If you guys are interested, the listeners, it's www.14ers.com. It's 14ers.com. And I'm just looking here, and you can click on the page that says Route Descriptions or 14er Routes. And going back to you, like Matt was saying, he's got the Pikes Peak in his backyard, and you can look here, and it's got a nice little topographical map here with the actual trail outlined on it. You can click on it and look at it, and it has the two different trails and the gain. He's got the two routes, the Pikes Peak northwest slopes, gain 4,300 feet, difficulty class 2, photo links, and then two, Pikes Peak east slope, standard, 7,500 feet gain, class 1 difficulty. So it does provide a nice description, and if you guys are interested there, again, it's 14ers.com. They also have a nice mountaineering safety page that you can click on for some of the different safety aspects of it, and making sure you have the gear. That was one of the questions I had earlier. Do you typically take along any type of survival equipment or a light survival pack, or how do you plan for the unexpected? Obviously weather, and in regards to that weather, is the weather there that volatile that it could be sunny 1 minute and thunderstorm the next?
It really can be. We have a saying out here in Colorado, if you don't like the weather, wait 15 minutes. And unfortunately, that goes the other way, too. You like the weather, okay, wait 15 minutes. The most essential piece of equipment that I could recommend is a satellite beacon for search and rescue, should you, God forbid, ever need it. And you can find these at sale at most of your sporting goods store. One of the devices is called a Spot. Forget off the top of my head what the full class is. Satellite is your notifying network that contacts the near search and rescue party in your area. And the nice thing about this device is you will actually receive confirmation on your end that the message has successfully gone through. So you're not sitting there waiting for help if it didn't actually go through. You'll know if it did or not. Absolutely positively invaluable, because there are unfortunately too many people who have died out on these mountains trying to do them because they fell, they got hurt, they had an injury, and they weren't with someone, or they were incapable of getting to help, or they were incapable of notifying help. It's very unfortunate and very sad, but these are simple steps you can take to prevent this from happening. I mean, let's face it, this is fundamentally, if things start going wrong, a very dangerous undertaking. But to not go into it with the appropriate equipment to do everything that you possibly can to assure your safety as much as you can, I can't imagine why you would do that.
Yeah, it's interesting, the correlation to where we are here in South Florida. We always hear from the Coast Guard, and I'm myself a Coast Guard licensed captain, you know, and particularly when you're planning trips or you're going out fishing or whatever, they say always file a float plan. Make sure that, you know, your relatives or loved ones or whoever, you know, you live with or whatever the case may be, make sure you tell them when you're going, when you plan on returning, and if not, who to contact and how to contact that.
That's another great point that I thank you for mentioning, because that's another easy thing you can do is, like I say, I am leaving when I do these. I have a wife who is back at home. I tell her what mountain I'm doing, what route I'm doing. I leave this information with her. She may not understand it. She may not know what, say, Cragg's Trail is. But as long as if something is wrong, she hasn't heard from me by a certain time, she can notify 911, which can notify the appropriate search and rescue, and pass along that information to people who will understand what it is. And if you don't have that Spot to help out, you at least have that. And the only other thing I can really recommend bringing, it does not take any weight at all, is some kind of flashlight or headlamp that has a strobe function. And the reason I recommend that is because if it's, say, after dark, a search and rescue comes looking for you, and you're too weak to say anything or shout or whatever, just having this thing just blinking is going to attract a lot of attention, and it's really going to expedite your rescue. So a lot of things you can do to help not guarantee but improve your safety are just real simple things, as you said. Tell someone where you're going to be, when you'll be back, and things like that.
And again, we're speaking with Matt Hoffman, and his website is 54summits.com. We're talking about climbing some mountains. If any ARFCOM members would like to chime in, we'd certainly like to hear from you before we ask a few more questions. The number is 415-762-1161. If you guys listening out there in ARFCOM land would like to have any questions for Matt. One of the things that I was looking for here was, you say the series premieres September 20th. How often do you plan on updating your blog in regards to these episodes? And how long, what can sort of the viewers on the web look for at 54summits.com when you do have the actual premiere?
The plan is going to be to do them weekly. Like most shows that have season one, it's going to be somewhere in the area of, I'm hoping to make it about 10 episodes, maybe a little more. But the one thing that may limit me is I'm applying for it soon. I don't know if I'll get it or not. But, again, YouTube, where I'm going to be hosting these videos, has a partner program. And one of the big advantages to that for me is that they will allow you to upload videos that are longer than 10 minutes. If I get that, great. There will only be one video for every episode. All you need to do is watch that. Unfortunately, if they do not get any partner status, then every week there will be a number of videos that will be available, however many are necessary to cover the full thing. And I don't want to make it excessive. I'm still kind of not sure if I want to go for, say, a 20-minute episode for each one or 40-minute. It's probably going to depend a lot more on what video I'm able to get, because I obviously don't want to waste people's valuable time by providing just the same thing over and over and over again to them.
And one of the things I noticed doing my own website of that in relation to the firearm videos and stuff that we like to do is that, and I'm not sure how many people out there in the listening audience are familiar with production of photography or radio shows or videos or whatever the case may be, but it for a little bit of insight, it takes an awful lot of footage to have anything. I mean, when I'm doing photo shoots, you know, you might go out and shoot 100 to 200 photos and only get, you know, 10 to 20 good photos. Or if you're going out and shooting video for your website or for a broadcast program, whatever the case may be, you know, you could go ahead and shoot 4 or 5 hours of footage. And if you're lucky, you get an hour out of it. If you're like most people, you get, you know, 10 minutes to a good half hour out of the video production. So for those out there that sort of wonder about editing and video and how these things are produced, you know, I know myself how to do it. It really takes an awful lot of time to get good quality dynamic video that's going to be engaging to your potential reception audience.
Oh, absolutely. The smallest amount of video that I've ever come back from a hike with has been an hour and 30 minutes. And out of that, I may be able to create a 20-minute video, maybe 25. There are a lot of things that when you're shooting this, you think to yourself, this would look good. And you shoot it, but when you get back and you're looking at it and you're reviewing it, you think to yourself, this is awful. And another thing to throw into the complexity with that is it's one thing to do that, like, for example, when you're out shooting. It's another thing to be doing it some 12, 13,000 feet in elevation where the air is thinner and you're exhausted while you're walking down the trail, and you need to be making these decisions on what you want to do while you're moving because you can't really afford to stop for too long. If you do, you're going to be getting off that mountain, like what happened to me, at around 2 o'clock, and you are going to be dodging lightning. So there is an ever-pressing timeline that is constantly nipping at my heels as I'm doing these things. So it's not uncommon for me to, you know, oh, what the heck, I'll just shoot it. And that's why I bring a lot of camera equipment with me. I have more than one or two batteries for the camcorder that I bring with me, more than one or two memory cards, because it's a lot easier to overshoot and then come back and say, okay, I can trim this here, I can trim this there, I don't need that, and discard things, than to be sitting there and saying, oh, God, I really needed that shot. And then have to make the decision about whether or not you're going to go back up and get it, or if you're just going to have to figure out a way around it.
Speaking of shooting, are you allowed to carry a firearm while you're on these trails? And if so, do you, and what is it?
It depends on the trail. If you're on, like, Culebra Peak, where it's all private property, you obviously have to adhere to whatever their rules are. However, the majority, in fact, I believe every single 14er that is on public land out here, with the exception of one, Long's Peak, every single 14er that's on public land out here is actually in national forest land, which is completely different from national park land. You know, they only recently allowed you to legally carry firearms inside national parks. That's only really going to come into play for me when I do Long's Peak. But as far as the others, it's really a decision you want to make about what am I doing. If it's a day hike, I'm just going up and back. People don't really want to hike 14,000 feet up to a mountain to start trouble. I have never heard of an instance of someone getting mugged or his life threatened or something like that on a mountain. However, the thing to keep in mind is not so much the human threat, but the wildlife element. So if it's a day hike, I may not bring something with me just because, well, I can't really think of a reason that I would actually need it. Plus, even if it is something light, like a polymer-framed compact handgun, that's still, with a loaded magazine in there, about 1 or 2 pounds that, over the course of 4,000, 5,000 feet elevation gain several miles, begins to feel more like 20 or 30. But if I'm going to be camping out overnight on the mountain to get closer to the summit for the morning, as I've done before, it does not hurt to have something like that, at the very least, just to have an option in the event of something like a bear encounter. It's not too often that that happens out here. It's even more rare that they ever actually attack people. But there was one recently in the Castle Peak area outside of Aspen where a bear ransacked a tent while the people weren't there because they had not stored their food properly. And that's usually the, you know, the 1 ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure application. It's easier to know how to properly store your food away from your campsite to sort of prevent or at least reduce the risk of having any dangerous wildlife encounters, as opposed to think to yourself, okay, I'm going to bring along my AR-15 with the 100-gram beta mag so that if any black bear wants to come up here and fight me for a power bar, I'm going to light him up. So, again, it's about smart planning.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't really, I guess I should have made my question a little bit more clear. I wasn't necessarily thinking about your average street thug gonna mug you for your wallet while you're way up that high. I'm sure they have better things to do down below in the city. But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not, you know, having never been to Colorado, I'm not real familiar with the wildlife, but I certainly have watched the you know, Discovery Channel and stayed in the Hampton Inn or whatever. I was thinking more along the lines of snakes, coyotes, bears, and whatever other, you know, crazy animals you guys have out there in the Rockies.
Most wildlife out here is not interested in making contact with humans. The most common bear that you'll come across out here, and even then not too often, is the black bear. And as far as bears go, yes, their effect to humans are obviously dangerous if you're nearby them. But the black bear is essentially a big sissy compared to, you can find grizzly bears further out west. Those guys, if they're hungry, they aren't afraid of you one bit. So that's another instance where putting your food a good distance away from your campsite in a bag, up in a tree, in a bear bag, is a lot wiser move than not even thinking about that.
Yeah, that would seem to be the case as well. Again, we have Matt Hoffman with 54summits.com, a noted ARFCOM member. Coming up, we will have our local industry insider, Reed Finch, coming on here in a few minutes. Matt, do you have any parting words for the Radio Free ARFCOM audience?
Only thing I can think to do is I myself need to catch up on this. I have several summit shots of the ARFCOM first logo flags that I need to get rendered and uploaded and posted into the team forum for everyone to check out. Beyond that, if you're not a team member and you want to check this out, I really encourage you to spend the $24, at least for the bronze membership, to become a team member, and not even then for these videos, just because it's an incredible community. You really are helping to contribute to the site when you buy a team membership. And if for no other reason than that alone, you should look at getting one. Otherwise, can't encourage everyone enough. Please check out the website, 54summits.com. Check out the promotional teaser trailer that we have out there. And the first show, the first episode, will air Monday, September 20th. Pass along words to friends and family. Looking forward to providing you with a great show in the future.
Matt, it's been a pleasure. Thank you again so much for your time, and we would love to have you back as a guest once we get a little bit closer or nearer on the premiere date in September. Again, we just had Matt Hoffman, a noted AR15.com member, with his new website, 54summits.com. Please, everybody, check that site out, and let's give Matt some support from the R15.com community. Thanks again, Matt. Again, I want to echo his sentiments regarding the team membership. If you guys want to go ahead and if for those of you that don't have team memberships, I'd highly recommend it. It's a really great way to support the site. It's a great way to support not only what Air15.com does on the internet, but they are, you know, reaching out to the world at large through the means of the internet to get our firearms information out there and to get our freedom protected and all that, and with help from sponsors and with help like from organizations like the NRA as well. Upcoming, we have we didn't really get to finish our conversation a couple weeks ago with Mr. Reed Finch. He's going to be on the line here shortly. We're going to talk about the new and upcoming products in the gun industry. He is a distributor that works for a company who sells to small gun stores such as myself here in Stuart, where I work at the American Defense Gun Store. He has a good inside track on what's out there, what's available. I've got a couple specific questions for him. I think Reed is on the line now. Mr. Reed, how you doing today, brother?
Good, doing good, man.
Good, good to hear from you. So tell me, what's going on with some of the new stuff coming out there? I know we've had a lot of inquiries about some of the new Bodyguard line from Smith & Wesson, you know, all kinds of new stuff coming out. What's some new and upcoming stuff the consumers can look at coming out, should be hitting the retail shelves here in the next weeks and months?
Actually, the new Bodyguard 38 Special, excuse me, that's already out. That just came out this week. So they should be seeing that in the retail stores pretty much ASAP. It's a great priced firearm, easy for concealment, like what we were talking about earlier, last time we had talked. Easy to carry, integrated with the, I want to say it's Insight laser grip, or excuse me, not the grip, but the Insight laser built onto it from the factory. And, it's just a great carry gun.
How about the other one, their 380 model that they're coming out? Isn't that supposed to be coming out here shortly?
It is. For some reason, we've just seen the first wave of the 38 Special, but the 380 should be following it up.
And with the 380 and the 38, obviously those are the concealment calibers. Are you still getting much demand in regards, if you look at the comparison? I know we sell an awful lot of the 380s, and it seems like the revolvers have taken a back seat, but obviously we're only one store. What have you seen from some of your clients across the country? Are the 380s really dominating the segment, or is there still a very strong market for the compact concealment lightweight revolvers?
It's a little bit of both. It really is. The wheel guns are tried and true. So, you know, for a concealed gun, they're always going to go bang 99.9% of the time when you need them to, which is what you're carrying it for to begin with, you know. However, the 380 is great as well.
Last week, I'm not sure if you caught the show, but we had Victor from tacticalnightvision.com, and he was describing he sells a lot to military, law enforcement, but he also does the private sector, and all his stuff is certainly top notch. It's his website's tnvc.com. But I noticed looking through your distributor catalog, you guys do offer some night vision products, and I was just kind of wondering, sort of to tie into last week's show, do you guys sell much of that to your local retailers? And if so, what are some of the products and their uses?
We do. I do have a big call for some A10, you know, night vision, whatnot. That's the main one that we do carry. A lot of people like to use them for, you know, predator control, coyote, you know, things of that nature. So I sell a lot to people who get to hunt, you know, big fields at night and stuff like that. I do have a call for a bunch of the Gen 4 stuff. However, that's more or less special order. But, I mean, it's great. I mean, it's fun stuff. It's really neat. And it's actually really taken on.
Have you found that the price point of some of that stuff's coming down? I mean, it used to be that a lot of the night vision equipment was, I mean, almost untouchable unless you were rich. Have you seen some of those price points start to come down where it's a more consumer-friendly price point for most buyers?
Yes, they really have. I mean, you can get in some of the, you know, like I said earlier, some of the Gen 1, Gen 2, even the Gen 3 stuff for, you know, really, really good price points. You know, if they go to their local gun store, you know, American Defense, wherever, you know, and say, hey, this is what I'm looking for. What can you get me this for? I think they'll really be surprised if they go in and just get a price. You know, I don't think it's a lot of stuff that people are going to have on their shelves, per se, like the stock, like you normally would, like a Leupold or, you know, Sporsky or something like that. But I really think they'd be surprised if they went and asked for it. And it's truly a lot of fun to shoot. I mean, if you've got the property or a nice shooting range that allows night shooting, I mean, it's just so much fun to use.
Speaking of fun to use, are you seeing, you know, obviously we were talking last week, we're seeing a lot of the tactical stuff moving. Are you seeing sporting items still moving as well, you know, considering your over-under shotguns, your bolt-action, you know, deer-type rifle or hunting-type rifles, as well as the tactical stuff?
They are. They really are moving very well. So, like I said before, I mean, I can't put my finger on a particular one, but they are moving very well.
And one of the things I know we had discussed, I don't know if it was last week or sometime over the phone at through our respective businesses, but here's a question for you. Where the heck are all the M1As and 1911s? Those seem to be the two most difficult guns for most shops to get a hold of and for dealers to stock. And start with the M1A. I mean, is it just that popular? Are they not making a lot of them? I mean, it's one of the, you know, arguably one of the best battle rifles ever produced. Why aren't there more of them out there on the market?
I think it's just the manufacturers for the demand of them is just through the roof. I'm really glad you got your hands on one. I would let people look at it for a while and not buy it. No, I'm just kidding. You know, it's just, they're just hard to get your hands on. I don't know if they do that stuff intentionally or anything like that. I really doubt they do that, but they are. I mean, they're just, the demand's so crazy for them. It's just hard to get your hands on.
And that's, you know, obviously Springfield is the only one making them, so I'm sure they can only manufacture so many. However, if you look at the 1911 market, it seems as if those are a very popular, high-demand item right now. You know, we had been looking for you guys for a couple months about trying to get some of the you know, the low to mid-end ones, whether they be your Rock Islands or your Tauruses, but also, you know, trying to get up and get the Colts or some of the other high-end brands. And you'd think for a gun that's as popular as the 1911 is, there'd be thousands of them. Is that, do you see the 1911 demand there for that customer base?
I do. I really do. And the neat thing is so many different manufacturers are bringing out their version, you know, of the 1911, and a lot of them are comparable. A lot of them, you know, are, you know, kind of what we said before, you get what you pay for. But it's really neat that somebody can come in on a budget and get a really good 1911. Another cool thing that a couple new manufacturers are doing is they're bringing back the 22 version of the 1911, kind of like the Colt Service Model 8, which is a, you know, really cool firearm and has its place in history. But so it's also, you can get somebody in shooting, right, give them a 1911, and 22 is affordable to shoot. So they can go out and have a great time shooting, enjoy the sport, and not really break the bank having to spend, you know, the money for the 45 ACP round. And there are a lot of great, you know, 1911s coming out in that, you know, $650 to $700 MSRP range with a lot of great features that you would normally pay more for. Not using one in particular, but, you know, the Taurus. I mean, it's got a lot of features done from the factory that, you know, your higher end 1911 would have, and they do it straight from the factory. So, I mean, there's a 1911 out there for everybody, as far as price range goes.
And you were saying about the 22 conversions, you've been selling an awful lot of those as well for a variety of different guns, and obviously now manufacturers have been taking note, selling the dedicated weapons platforms, whether it be a 1911 in 22 or an AR-15 in 22. Are the sales still strong in those?
They really are. They really are. Because, you know, it just boils down to people just want to get out and shoot and have a good time. You know, and times are tight for a lot of people. You know, and you kind of hate it because you enjoy your sport. But at the same time, you know, I mean, bottom line, you got to put food on the table. And when you can go out there and enjoy your sport, let's say you got an AR, you know, you buy the upper and all that and convert it. And you can still go out there and still have a fun time and let everybody shoot. It's great. The same thing goes for the handguns. And these big manufacturers are really, really taking note of that. So there's a lot of great different components. You can still enjoy shooting your tactical rifles in 22 and have fun, either run through, you know, fun drills for, you know, personal defense, stuff like that, and still get to shoot your gun.
And for specifically the AR15.com audience that we have here, what are some of the most popular accessories that are being sold right now? What are some of the things that you really like and that you've been really impressed with that would be specific for the AR-15 platform?
Let's see here. On the economy end, VFA's come out with some really cool items as far as their scopes go for the AR-15. They got like a laser designator. Really cool. A lot of fun to use. That's going to be, you know, you ever take in the $150 to $250 range. Trigicon always has just outstanding stuff. I mean, it's not in everybody's price range, but, you know, it is good stuff. I mean, it's just, sky's the limit. I mean, it just all depends on really what you want to, you know, spend your money on.
Well, now, one of the reasons I ask is because if you look at the catalog from your company between last year and this year, they actually installed a tactical section into it, and, you know, you've got a good selection now of product, whereas last year it was the variety wasn't nearly as much there for the tactical stuff for the dealers and looking at what you guys have in your catalog as a distributor, whereas this year your distributor catalog I can show to a lot of my customers and saying, hey, if you want to order this product, we can get it for you. But are you finding that even what you would call, you know, your average mom-and-pop gun store, are they also taking advantage of getting a lot of the market in this tactical accessories and ordering a lot more of that product into their stores?
I think they are. I think, and don't quote me on this, but this is just, you know, personal perception. I think a lot of the mom and pop stores are used to the wheel gun, you know, the lever action, standard shotgun, stuff like that. I also think they're kind of missing out on a very huge market, you know, and whoever's listening out there will probably understand this when they walk in and go, hey, I'm looking for this quad rail for yada, 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 and they just kind of look at you like a deer in the headlights look, you know. So then I have to drive them to the internet. And I honest to goodness think that if those stores would carry a little bit, I'm not saying dedicate half their store or the whole store, but just a little bit, you know, they would find they would bring in a whole new clientele, you know, that would really not only continue to shop there and keep them from having to go to the internet or wherever they go, but it really benefit them because it's a very huge growing trend in the AR world and black gun market and all this other good stuff, you know. So these other big manufacturers have really, you know, jumped on board, I guess you can say, and go, wait a minute, you know, this stuff's really selling. This isn't just somebody wanting to deck out an AR just for fun. I mean, they've got probably more than one AR that they would like to deck out in different configurations because, you know as well as I do, you can make your ARs as personalized as you want to. And no two are never the same once you start, you know what I mean, customizing them to your likes.
Well, speaking to that point that you just made, you know, I make a point as being in the retail end of it, the internet is a love-hate relationship for most of us retailers simply because a customer will come in and they've found, you know, the most obscure AR part that's out there made by one tiny company out somewhere, and we as retailers really have no way of getting a lot of that stuff. And the other thing is that with the thousands and thousands and thousands of components out there for ARs and the myriad configurations, it's impossible to have everything out there on the shelf. So we have to be very selective in the stock that we choose to have in the store and hope that for most people's application, you know, obviously there's a several different classes of AR buyers, the first class being, you know, guys like me who have researched it and I know exactly what I want and I'm going to get it one way or the other versus Joe on the street just got his AR and he wants to put a rail on it. He may not know that the difference between a Daniel Defense rail or a Luru tactical rail or whatever the case may be. So I imagine that on your end, as a distributor, you guys have to, your buyers in particular, would have to be pretty selective in choosing quality product to be able to sell.
You're absolutely right as far as the love-hate relationship goes. I mean, it's like when I was running the store that I was at, you know, there's so much great stuff out there, and there's always new stuff popping up. So you really do have to be careful into what you bring in. You don't want to overstock stuff that nobody's going to buy. You know, so then you're just stuck with it and ends up on a clearance rack for 10 years. But if my philosophy is if you keep it simple, you know, listen to your customer because that's who's buying your product. I mean, you can buy cool stuff for your store all day long, but if nobody's buying it, then it's not really that cool. But bottom line, just listen to your customer, listen to what they want, what their needs are. And go from there and offer them a variety. You know, if somebody comes in and says, hey, I want to buy this right here, you know, say, why don't you check this one out? Or ask them what their price range is. You know, I only want to spend $250 on these flip-up sites. Okay, cool. Well, we can go this route. These guys are really good. They make a good product. It's going to do what you need it to do, you know, and you'll be good to go that way from the retail side. On the side where I'm at, you're right as far as the buyers. I mean, they have to be careful. I mean, because there is so much stuff out there that it'd almost be crazy to try and stock it all because every day somebody's coming out with something neat and a new adaptation to this or whatever to make this better or that better or anything like that. But I mean,
are you finding that many of the retail shop owners who, or guys like me who are managers but also basically the buyers for the store, are you finding that many of them are getting a lot more educated on some of the Black Rifle stuff and knowing a little bit more what to ask for and calling and getting the quality products and knowing about what the products are and what's out there?
They are, because it goes back to just listening to your customer. Your customer is going to be nine times out of ten, your customer is going to know about the product before you do. That's what I've always found. I mean, there's something new coming out every single day. And until your customer walks in and goes, Ben, have you heard about this? You know, you're going to be like, wait a minute. No, I haven't, but let me check that out for you and let me see if we can make it happen. You know, and same on my end. I mean, I see new stuff every day, and I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool. I wish I'd have thought of that, you know. But they are being educated, and they're going the extra mile to learn more because you have to stay afloat in this industry. I mean, you just don't have a choice. So they are definitely, you know, going the extra mile, trying to figure out what the customer needs and demands are. and trying to fulfill those.
Right. That's, I mean, that's a great point. I mean, we always hear about stuff, you know, as soon as the latest issue of American Rifleman or Guns and Ammo magazine comes out, I have customers walking, beating down the door saying, I got to have this product. And it's the media, you know, and a lot of times doesn't do us any favors, I don't think, not intentionally, but when the gun writers get all the products, a lot of times it's 6 months till that's out. They get it in their hands, and a lot of times it's 6 months out till it hits the sales floor, making it a little bit challenging to say, hey, you know, look, you know, I appreciate you're asking about the product, and I'd certainly love to have it on the shelf for you to buy right away, but that's just not the reality of it.
You're right. It's kind of frustrating on both ends, on your end, on the retail end, and, you know, on mine. And I don't know if that's the way they judge their manufacturing of the product. You know, they say, hey, let's go ahead and throw it out there and do what bites and what doesn't bite. Honest to goodness, I have no idea. But it is frustrating, you know. So.
All right, Mr. Reed, if you have any parting words, otherwise I really appreciate you coming on the line with me again and speaking to me about some of the industry stuff, and we'll look forward to having you back on soon, sir.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ben, for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks again, Reed, and keep us up to date. We'll have you on from time to time letting us know what's out there. If Reed, you know how to get a hold of me, and if the ARFCOM listeners out there have any questions for Reed or they want to know some more inside stuff about what goes on in the industry as far as, you know, distributors and how the whole process of acquisition and retail and dealers and distributors and all that fun stuff works. And again, you know, acquiring product or getting those sorts of things, Reed would be happy to answer your questions, and I'd be happy to have him on again. So thanks again, Reed. We are at that point in the program where we go to the zombie tip of the week on air15.com zombie forum. This week it is catchphrase. If you were trapped and just slew an entire horde of zombies, what would your catchphrase be when you were done killing them? Everyone has to have a catchphrase or something that they would say that is badass after killing them and surviving a mini Armageddon, posts El Presidente NRK. Under that, his tagline is White Chocolate Valentine. His is It's a Good Day to Die. Below that we have, did you see the size of that chicken? What we got down here? From Dark Ninja, he posts, man, the guys on ARFCOM are going to love this. Clean up on aisle 3, parlay, and can you hear me now? Scrolling down further, Glock Rocker 2 says, quote, I should have changed my underwear. Under that, he also adds, well, ain't this a kick in the head? Below that, we have Gray Guy saying, looks like I picked the wrong day to stop sniffing glue. ETA, F it, dude, let's go bowling, would be a close second. That is your ARFCOM, Radio Free ARFCOM zombie tip of the week. In light of that, there's also a little reminder here that for those fans of Day by Day Armageddon, the little zombie novel that many of us like is by J.L. Bourne. His sequel is actually out tomorrow. I don't know if any of you who have read Day by Day Armageddon, how it ends, but it's a little bit open-ended. So now those of us looking forward to it have Beyond Exile coming out on Tuesday the 13th. If you haven't read the first one, then you are already a zombie. If you guys have any questions for me or you want to respond to the show, go ahead and send me an IM at FL_flyfishing_guide. I'd be happy to have your comments and send me some IMs and let me know what you thought of the show tonight. We really appreciate having our guests on. We had Matt Hoffman talking about his 54summits.com, a real nice, a cool website with a real cool adventure that he's putting together. It will be available free. The episode premieres September 20th. So we are all looking forward to that. Thanks again, Matt. Also, we had Reed Finch on talking about some different products and demand from the distributor side. So if you guys are wondering why your favorite retail store may or may not have the product that you're looking for, he's the guy to pose the question to, and we can get some answers out of him, hopefully. So, again, thank you, Radio Free ARFCOM fans, and be sure to accidentally the whole show next week. Be sure to tune in next week for another great show. But until then, this has been your Radio Free ARFCOM. Good night, everybody.
The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache.